This is the 46th study in our series of studies in soteriology, what the Bible teaches about salvation, and it's the third in our sub-series on lapsarianism, that big word that is so much a part of our everyday vocabulary, right? But it's built on the Latin word lapsus, which means fall or descent, a going down. And so lapsarianism has to do with, theologically, the fall, a going down. And it's concerned particularly with being able to describe the place of the fall with relation to election. Those are the two most important elements. And we are comparing four theological systems from the standpoint of thinking in terms of God's logical outworking of his plan. We can identify many of the features of his plan, such as election and the fall and the cross and many other things that go into this that are part of these four theological systems. And we want to think about the possible logical order in God's mind of these elements of these four systems, and this will help us as a piece of litmus paper does to reveal acidity or alkalinity. This should help us and will help us to understand more about these systems and whether they're true to the Bible. So if you have your notes, take a look please at that chart on page 8, which we stopped with last time. And I want to mention a few things about this, and you may want to scribble on your note pages. That you can see that there are four schools of theology, four whole schools of theology with regard to God's overall plan for the universe. The first two, I would say, are the schools of thinking of most people who call themselves Christians today. So you have Arminianism and Emeraldianism, or four-point Calvinism, or modified Calvinism, some would call it. Most quote-unquote Christians, and I'm putting Christians in quotes as I speak, because I think many of the people in the first column are saved on the wrong biblical basis. And probably believing very much the wrong things and may not even be saved. I think many of them are not. But for those who name the name of Christ, if we can put it that way, the first two columns would constitute most of those people today. And then the last two columns, moderate Calvinism and high Calvinism, Calvinism, I would guess, don't know of any accurate way to determine it, but I would say that Calvinists are maybe true Calvinists, and I would say that only people in those last two columns are true Calvinists, even though the Amaraldians would say they're Calvinistic or Calvinists, and other people, some people in the last two columns would call modified Calvinism the second column, Amaraldianism four-point Calvinism, they'd say, yeah, they're Calvinists for some reasons. I prefer not to because, as we mentioned many times and we'll mention again, see again today, I think Amaraldianism, four-point Calvinism, collapses when you look very carefully about the pieces of what they believe and how they interrelate and the logical, internal logical problems. I think Amaraldianism collapses into Arminianism. In other words, it's just a variation of Arminianism and does not have the biblical basis that the last two columns do. But again, we emphasize, and I have underlined the word election in this chart. Notice that from left to right, it moves higher and higher in each of the four columns. And again, the question is, what is the order between the fall and election? And you can see in the first column that election comes way after the incident of the fall in God's God's plan. In the second column, the fall is still ahead of election. In the third column, the fall comes before election again. In the last, only in the last column does election come before the fall. We'll talk more about that. The first line of beliefs under Arminianism is to create the universe. Apparently, under Arminianism, that's God's initial, the initial point of God's, the progress in God's thinking about and plan about the universe. In Arminianism, then, God's overall plan is to have a universe with people in it. Same thing for four-point Calvinism. And probably the same thing for moderate Calvinism. But not so for superlapsarianism, high Calvinism. Their election has risen to the top, and election is the very first thing in God's plan. We'll talk about more, that more in detail. So I want you to think about, I encourage you to think about this chart, and we're going to refer back to it over and over again. So let's take each column and think about the place of election, the relative places of election and the fall. So here we go on in our notes. And by the way, with regard to Arminianism, I doubt very much that there are Arminians who would think through the logic of God's plan. It just sort of, what they're believing just sort of happens without reference to an overall understanding of God's plan. So, in Arminianism, as we look at it, God first planned logically to create the universe, then to permit, and the Arminian does not want, does not, would say that God didn't really want the fall to happen, but it did. Humans are to blame for it. So they have God permitting the fall, and then God steps in to fix everything. And so he decides to provide salvation for everyone who ever lives. And then eventually to call them through the gospel presentation, gospel call, call them to salvation and label or view as elect those who happen to believe. So human beings caused the fall. It's their fault. And human beings can get saved. God did not want the fall to happen. It messed up. In a certain sense, we could say it messed up his plan for a happy universe. But he provides for everybody on the cross, and those who are saved are the ones who decide on their own to come. And practically speaking, of course, that is very prominent in Arminianism. You decide to come to Christ. It's all on you. And for most Arminians, you can lose your salvation. And so just as you decide to come to Christ, you can decide to leave Christ. So in this system, God makes it possible for everyone to believe or be saved through a universal atonement. And only after that does he particularize, move toward individual salvation. But people choose on their own, through their own free will. And so he is just a, he's watching what happens. He is at the mercy of human choice. But since universal atonement is not biblical, something we've demonstrated at length in previous studies, then the logical sequence found in Arminianism is not valid. Notice also that the main goal seems to be the creation of the universe, with the fall as an intervention that humans brought about. So in Arminianism, would they think through enough to say that God was surprised by the fall? They might come to that conclusion. And again, in Arminianism, election comes after the fall, so we could call this infra lapsarianism, the election comes infra, comes after the fall. Let's think about Amaraldianism. And again, you can jump back and forth as I'm describing this to the chart. And I would give you the same caveat as with regard to Arminianism. I don't think Amaraldians think through the plan of God and its pieces and the logical sequence. If they did, they would begin to see some of the big problems with their system. But we can, I think, analyze Amaraldianism in terms of what God might be thinking if it were true. So with respect to logical relationships, Amaraldianism differs from Arminianism mainly in that election is supposedly unconditional and logically comes before God's plan or decree to call people to salvation. Notice in first column, Arminianism, God calls, and then whoever responds, why, they're the elect. Amaraldianism reverses that. So in Arminianism, the first column, God genuinely asks everyone who hears to respond to the gospel. He really, really wants everyone to be saved. While in Amaraldianism, he expects, I have the word asks in your notes, and I think the word expects would be better. He only expects the elect to respond. That is, the call is in some way limited to the elect. Recall, however, that logically, and as the steps are worked out in space and time, Amaraldianism, as I said a moment ago, actually resolves itself into Arminianism, in that ultimately an individual elects himself, because in Amaraldianism, four-point Calvinism, a person exercises faith, and then he is regenerated. Great, great biblical problem. How can I, if I am an enemy of God, hate him, respond positively to a gospel invitation? Ephesians 5 by itself demolishes the election position of the and regeneration position of the Amaraldian. Notice also that in Amaraldianism, God permits the fall, as in Arminianism. He permits it. He's reluctant, but he lets it happen. He lets Adam and Eve transgress. Sin entering the picture is an accident. It's an undesirable twist in God's plan. Both of these systems are saying God couldn't control it. Also, as in Arminianism, the death of Christ is universal in intent. Since we've already demonstrated that God could not have had universal intent in the cross, the logical sequence for Amaraldianism cannot be valid either. While most writers speak of Amaraldianism as falling within Calvinism, as I mentioned a moment ago, as reflected in the term four-point. I'm a Calvinist, but I'm only four-point, say some. I reject this categorization because of my conclusion that it's only a type of Arminianism due to its universal provision of salvation and the fact that election is dependent on the individual and therefore not a sovereign, unconditional choice of God. Amaraldians have trouble with unconditional election because of the belief that people can exercise faith before they are born again by God. Let's think about the third column, moderate Calvinism or sub-lapsarianism, sub meaning that election would come after the fall. After the fall, the word means. I'd like you to turn in your notes to page 17. To an expansion of this little chart, and we'll eventually come to this big chart. But page 17, I've reproduced the columns and added a little bit to there, two more columns, which we'll talk about later. But if you look at the, from the right, one, two, the third column from the right, under moderate Calvinism, you'll see I've identified some of the people down through the years who have held to moderate Calvinism. So I say majority of Calvinists fall under that category. John Owen, Death of Death and the Death of Christ. Matthew Henry, famous for his big commentary on the Bible. George Whitfield, who preached not very far from here. Jonathan Edwards, whom some have called America's greatest theologian. Spurgeon. Hodge, a 19th century theologian. Lorraine Bettner, a 20th century Calvinist, has written very good stuff. Benjamin Warfield, taught at Princeton Seminary a little over 100 years ago. R.C. Sproul, whom most people today would be familiar with, now with the Lord. Albert Mohler, very prominent today among evangelicals. John MacArthur, who most of you have heard about. They would fall under moderate Calvinism. So it's possible with regard to Arminianism and Amiraldianism to put their assumptions about the logic of God's plan in the form we see in the chart above, but the errors of these two schools of thinking are easily revealed through other means. Now it's with regard to moderate Calvinism and high Calvinism, the last two columns, that this lapsarianism tool helps us the most. Notice that the moderate Calvinist places election after the fall. So it's sub the fall, sub-lapsarian, after the fall comes election in God's logic. We'll see that this is unbiblical. It also places election before the provision of salvation on the cross. So God chooses people and then provides for their salvation. That's true. This is due to the correct view that the definite atonement is biblical. And this part of the sequence in moderate Calvinism is okay. It's biblical. However, notice that the first goal in God's planning is apparently to create the universe, with the fall coming as an intrusion on that goal. So, as with the first two systems, a moderate Calvinism, the Calvinism where most Calvinists would find themselves today, in this, it is the same as Arminianism and Amiraldianism. God's first goal is to create the universe. The fall then comes as an intrusion on that first goal, as with the first two schools. Similarly, election coming after the fall seems to be dependent on the fall for its existence. So God creates the universe, looking at your chart. God allows for the fall, and then he elects some. The election operates then on fallen people in God's thinking. So he's got the universe, moderate Calvinism. He's got, he allows for the fall, and then he elects some, but the fall has already occurred, so when he elects, he's choosing from this set of people that are already fallen. That will be important. Laying out the likely steps, if we could call them that, in God's planning, as lapsarianism does, our litmus test, enables us to see more clearly this problem point in the thinking of moderate Calvinists, who in general do not want to say that God intended for the fall to occur. So again, basically in moderate Calvinism, the fall is an intrusion. God doesn't really want it. Moderate Calvinists would rather say that God permitted the fall. They acknowledge that God is sovereign over the universe, but most of them, and this is important, I've underlined it in my notes, but most of them cannot bring themselves to say that God caused the fall, since they immediately conclude that God would then be evil He'd be a God who forces people to sin. This is the key point in the, I believe, in the difference between moderate Calvinism and high Calvinism. And by the way, if you haven't figured it out yet, you'll see me land in high Calvinism. So here's the question. Did God permit the fall? Did he allow the fall? Or did he cause the fall? Modern Calvinists would say, that makes God the author of sin. And that can't be. It's important to recall what we've already said in our studies in soteriology about the place and source of evil in the universe. We found that the work of Gordon Clark provides crucial answers to the problems of human free will, the problem of human responsibility, and God's sovereignty with regard to sin. Clark's basic purpose is not to answer the question of the source of sin, but to address the question of how God's existence can be harmonized with the existence of evil in the universe. That's a big problem, too. A valid question to investigate. One of the points that Clark addresses is the question of how God can be good and still have evil or sin in the world. Legitimate question for anyone to deal with, but more importantly for our purposes, it's essentially the dilemma that comes to the fore in the theology of the moderate Calvinist. If God's responsible in any way for sin, then he's an evil God. We can't say that God is evil, so he must not be responsible for sin. Now, down through the centuries, many, including the Arminian, especially the Arminian, have said that in order to absolve God of responsibility for sin, we should lay the responsibility squarely at the feet of the individual, who, in order to be the origin of sin, must have completely free will. So you will find the Arminian and the Amaraldian defending free will. If the choice to sin is solely a human one, then God is off the hook. The big question, however, is whether or not we really have free will. Last Sunday, I happened to see one of the popular Amaraldian preachers on television with big church, and he was preaching on predestination, and he said, I don't understand the relationship between what humans do and God's plan, God's sovereignty. He said it's like two railroad tracks. One is free will and one is God's sovereignty, and as you look down the railroad tracks, they appear to converge, and spiritually, when we're in heaven, maybe we'll see the solution, but I don't see the solution to the existence at the same time of human free will and God's sovereignty. They appear to merge, but I don't know how they can be reconciled. But he wanted to maintain, an Amaraldian, wanted to maintain free will at all costs. So, do we have free will or not? That's the big question. With regard to free will, Clark would say that Judas made a choice as a free agent, but the choice was determined by God. So he made a choice, but the choice was determined by God. Clark makes a difference between making a choice, which we can do in freedom, and the object of that choice, which is determined by God. Judas' will was not free, but his choosing faculty was. So he can do choosing, but what he actually chooses is not free. That's the distinction. Judas made a choice that was sin, yet although it was determined by God, God is not chargeable with sin. Judas was responsible for the sin. The Bible tells us that clearly, not God. Our wills are not free because we are bound by our corrupted natures always to choose disobedience to God's revealed will. So we choose, the act of choosing is done in freedom. The objects of what we choose are not. Clark argues from biblical events and individuals such as Judas, Herod, and Pilate, and also the Jews and the Gentiles involved with the cross. He argues that some kind of divine determination, determinism exists, yet human beings are not puppets and can still be held responsible. As we just saw, Judas could not have done otherwise, but made willing choices and was held responsible. It's the crux of the problem. How could he be held responsible if he could not have done otherwise? But clearly that's what the Bible says. He was responsible for his sin, but he could not have done otherwise. How can we explain this? So why can human beings be held responsible within a universe where God is sovereign? Simply because God holds them responsible. That's Clark's answer, and I think it's brilliant. Very simple and obvious, but brilliant. We are responsible if we must answer for what we do. We must be answerable to someone, and that someone is God. Responsibility presupposes a higher authority who rewards and punishes. That authority must be God. So God is justified in punishing Judas, in punishing Herod, punishing Pontius Pilate for their role in the crucifixion of Christ, even though God determined ahead of time that the cross and all the events surrounding it would come to pass. God determined the events of the cross, yet the people who carried it out were responsible and punished. God is sovereign, but he is also just, and whatever he does is just simply because he does it. So that's one immediate argument against the supposition that if God caused the cross to happen, he's unjust. No, you can't say that. God is not unjust about anything. If he punishes someone, then that punishment is just and the person is responsible. And by the way, if this seems hard, it is deep and it's difficult, but if it seems hard to take in at first, remember that first of all, we don't like this kind of thinking. We want to retain some kind of honor and glory for ourselves, and we'd rather jump at the opportunity to blame God for something rather than blame ourselves. Of course, this recalls Romans 9 with the question about the fairness of God and Paul's picture of the potter. God can create, Paul says, some vessels that are destined for destruction, and of course, destined for sin before that, and yet God cannot be legitimately accused of being unjust. Romans 9 is very important in this whole discussion. But we still don't like to think that God is the author or cause of sin. Can we avoid this? Remember, the open theist goes to the extreme and says, if something sinful happens, it's not God's fault. He didn't plan it. He didn't want it. In fact, he couldn't even control it at all. He's at the mercy of totally at the mercy of what human beings do. But at this point, Clark introduces the principle of secondary causes. Human beings and their actions are secondary causes in God's determination of events in the universe, yet people are still not robots and can be held responsible. So we've already seen people can be held responsible and they're not robots, they make choices. But does this make God the cause and author of sin? Clark says this, let it be unequivocally said that this view certainly makes God the cause of sin. Wow, that's a powerful statement, isn't it? God is the cause of sin. God is the sole ultimate cause of everything. This is something people forget. If sin is in the universe, then since God is the cause of everything, it's in a universe that he created, and therefore sin is part of what he created in some way. There's absolutely nothing independent of him. He alone is the eternal being, says Clark. He alone is omnipotent. He alone is sovereign. Not only is Satan his creature, but every detail of history was eternally in his plan. Ephesians 1:11, I would say. The plan of the one who works all things according to the counsel of his will. And Clark says this was in his plan, all in his plan before the world began. And he has willed that it should all come to pass. God determined that Christ should die. He determined as well that Judas should betray him. There was never the remotest possibility that something different could have happened. Do you accept that? I do. I think that's what Scripture says when you think about Judas in Romans 9 and Pharaoh and the others there, the vessels. And Esau, nothing different could have happened. Clark goes on. When, accordingly, the discussion comes to God's being the author of sin, one must understand the question to be, is God the immediate cause of sin? Or more clearly, does God commit the actual sin? This is a question concerning God's holiness. Now, it should be evident that God no more commits sin than he is writing these words. Although the betrayal of Christ was foreordained from eternity as a means of effecting, bringing about the atonement, it was Judas, not God, who betrayed Christ. The secondary causes in history are not eliminated by divine causality, but rather they are made certain. And the acts of these secondary causes, in this case Judas, whether they be righteous acts or sinful acts, are to be immediately referred to the agents. By the way, if you do something righteous, where does that come from? If Judas committed a sin and it was part of God's plan, if you commit something righteous, where does that come from? It comes from God, right? That's part of God's plan. You can't say, oh, look how righteous, look at the righteous things I'm doing. That's from God also. Justice or righteousness is not a standard external to God to which he's obligated to submit. Righteousness is what God does. Since God caused Judas to betray Christ, this causal act is righteous and not sinful. By definition, God cannot sin. At this point, it must be particularly pointed out that God's causing a man to sin is not sin. It wasn't sin when God caused Judas to sin. There's no law superior to God which forbids him to decree sinful acts. And you might think again of the open theist who's got things that are superior to God because he's not an infinite God. True it is that if a man, a created being, should cause or try to cause another man to sin, Clark says, this attempt would be sinful. The reason is plain. The relation of one man to another is entirely different than the relation of God to any man. God's the creator, man's a creature. So God caused Judas to sin. God was not a sinner in that. If I cause someone to sin, I am a sinner, so God's different from me. The relation of a man to the law is equally different from the relation of God to the law. What holds in the one situation does not hold in the other. God has absolute and unlimited rights over all created things. If we believe that, we're not going to have much trouble with our overall theology. Of the same lump, Romans 9, he can make one vessel for honor and another for dishonor. The clay has no claims on the potter. The idea that God is above law can be explained in another particular. The laws that God imposes on men do not apply to the divine nature. You see, when people say, oh, if God caused the fall, then he was sinning. No such law of righteousness or sin applies to God. He's above all of that. Such things are applicable only to human conditions, Clark says. For example, God cannot steal, not only because whatever he does is right, but also because he owns everything. Great sense of humor. There's no one to steal from. Thus, the law that defines sin envisages human conditions and has no relevance to a sovereign creator. So even to raise the question of whether God sins or not is to misunderstand who God is. And by the way, that's the questions in Romans 9. Paul finally says, you're asking the wrong question. It's impertinent. In fact, it's impertinent to be asking this because you don't understand who God is. He's the potter who can do what he was with the clay. So Clark says, as God cannot sin, so in the next place, God is not responsible for sin, even though he decrees it. Clark rightly points out here that the concept of sin does not extend to God, since he himself is the standard for what sin is. Man's responsible, says Clark, because God calls him to account. Man's responsible because the supreme power can punish him for disobedience. God, on the contrary, cannot be responsible for the plain reason there's no power superior to him. So again, to ask the question, how can God do that? God would be a bad God if he does that. That's a basic misunderstanding of who God is. Those are categories that cannot apply to God. He's above all of that. So Clark concludes, man has no free will, for salvation is purely of grace and God is sovereign. His reasoning and his conclusions are grounded in Paul's great words found in Romans 9, particularly the figure of the potter. Let's remind ourselves of what Paul says. Verse 19 of Romans 9, one of you will say to me, then why does God still blame us? For who resists his will? But who are you, O man, to talk back to God? And this is what I was just saying. You're wrong to even ask this question. I won't answer it because it's an impertinent question. You don't understand who God is. Shall what is formed say to him who formed it, why did you make me like this? Does not the potter have the right to make out of the same lump of clay some pottery for noble purposes and some for common use? What if God, choosing to show his wrath and make his power known, bore with great patience the objects of his wrath prepared for destruction? And by the way, notice that Paul doesn't answer that, and I take it that means he is thinking the answer should be obvious. What if he did this to make the riches of his glory known to the objects of his mercy, whom he prepared in advance for glory, even us whom he also called, not only from the Jews, but also from the Gentiles? Paul doesn't answer it because it's impertinent to question whether God can do what he wants to do. The potter is indeed free to do as he wishes, then, making humans responsible for their sin. This provides a satisfactory answer for the question of the source of sin, as well as for the question of guilt and responsibility. It supports the position of the high Calvinist over against the moderate Calvinist and certainly the other schools, including, first, God's causing the fall. Can God cause the fall? Yes. He's the cause of everything. He did cause the fall. Secondly, the existence of equal ultimacy and reprobation. God works as much in the reprobate as he does in the elect to cause their destinies to come to pass. And finally, the fallacy of mere permissive versus passive reprobation. Does God simply allow the reprobate to go their way? And if we answer the question of God's sovereignty and his freedom to do as he wishes without our being able to question it, then we'll have the right answers to these questions. So what does all of this do for us as we try to understand and compare theological positions? The moderate Calvinist says that God planned to allow the fall to occur. Planned to allow. His plan included allowing. So there was a plan, but it only allowed. The Arminian and Amaraldian would say, no, he didn't even want that. Right? And this occurred before a selection of people to bless and condemn in the logical order. But notice the problem with this. God's plan includes the fall, but he's not responsible for it in any way. That's what the modern Calvinist has to conclude. God's plan includes the fall, but he's not responsible for it. There's something really wrong with that. We have to conclude from this that God plans, but is not sovereign in the outworking of his plan, or that God both wants the fall and doesn't want the fall. We'll stop at this point, and next time we will look in detail at high Calvinism or supralapsarianism as we conclude this sub-series on lapsarianism, the litmus of testing for theological positions. Let's bow together in prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for your word, and thank you for such great passages as Romans 9 that we find ourselves coming back to over and over that tell us so much about who you are and how your plan works out in the universe. We pray these things in Jesus' name.